Windy City Queer Cast.
Gays and lesbians are all the rage.
We're here and we're queer.
Windy City Queer Cast.
Windy City Queer Cast.
Windy City Queer Cast.
Windy City Queer Cast.
We're talking mega gay.
Ooh, I like that.
I'm Amy Matheny.
This program is brought to you in part by American Airlines, offering exciting GLBT vacations online at aa.com/rainbow.
Listening to the Windy City Queer Cast, show number 506. I'm Amy Matheny, and I can't believe it because you guys know how I like to gab. And there's one thing I haven't talked about, and it's, you know, it's a couple weeks away. One knows that everyone in my inner circle that I've bumped into, I have spoken with about this, but I haven't talked to you guys on the Queer Cast and all of you listeners about Jodie Foster. You know I'm late when Saturday Night Live has already spoofed her. But I thought, hey, before I got started on the show today, which is super exciting, that I might call in another fellow lesbian journalist who's a little bit older than I am. I hope she doesn't mind me saying that. And a little bit more of a contemporary of Jodie Foster, just to talk about what this means for Jodie Foster, how we as LGBT and especially lesbians receive the information and just kind of get it out there and dish. So I have Tracy Baim on the show with me, the publisher of Windy City Times. Hey, Tracy, how are you?
Hi, I'm great. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, I am psyched. I can't believe it's taken me this long, but we had to send Mitchell off on a boat somewhere, you know? So that was last week's show. So
my plot worked.
Exactly. Exactly. We got him out of town. But Jodie Foster, her speech, everyone was talking about it the day after the Golden Globes, the night it was happening on the Golden Globes. Did you see that coming at all?
I saw it coming certainly eventually. A couple of years ago, she kind of did it a little semi-coming out at an event where she thanked her girlfriend, who then she dumped. So I think that I felt like she would eventually do it. I don't think I saw it coming this quickly or this boldly at Golden Globes, even though some people think it wasn't bold at all. I do think that it was a huge step forward for her and her journey. So, yeah, I wasn't expecting it this soon. She just turned 50 years old. I just turned 50 as well. So you're right. I'm very much a contemporary. But I do feel like for two white lesbians who grew up in America, I don't think we could have had more diverse paths to who we are than what she experienced and what I experienced. So it is fascinating for me to have watched her all throughout her career and where she's at today.
Yeah, I mean, just to talk about the stage for once, I just thought that, you know, a lot of people have been coming out over the years, maybe not as big a name as Jodie Foster or not somebody that all of us in the LGBT community are kind of like, come out, come out, come out, come out, you know, but to pick one of the biggest, I mean, I think it's one of the biggest international stages you could come out on. It's the foreign press. People around the world are watching it. It's, you know, right in the middle of the Golden Globes. You can only almost the only thing that would be bigger would be the Oscars for her, an arena where people are watching her simultaneously. I mean, it was not a little tweet or a comment to a blogger like, you know, Frank Ocean or like Anderson Cooper. I mean, this was on a stage with all eyes on you and seemed very calculated, didn't you think?
Well, yes, I definitely think she rehearsed that speech about a million times in front of the mirror and had no idea how nervous she was going to get, because she wasn't really prepared for that. I do think that people that have been criticizing her forget how big a stage that was. And you're right. Anderson Cooper came out in a blog post, I mean, in a answer to a blog question last summer, and he was on vacation or out of the country.
Yep.
So I thought that, you know, that's his way of coming out, but hardly anybody attacked him.
Yeah.
For doing it that way. And he's been just as long closeted as Jodie Foster, and he wrote an autobiography where he didn't even mention he was gay.
Yeah.
So I felt like Anderson Cooper was living even more of a dishonest life in that sense. You write an autobiography, you really need to be honest. And while Foster has not been out, she's never had a beard. She's never really denied the reports in the tabloids whenever they pictured her with her girlfriend. So she lived this semi-closeted public life in a way that Anderson Cooper got away with much longer. So I do think that, you know, it wasn't a perfect coming out, but I don't understand the anger, maybe some of it is even sexism, that's directed at her, that it wasn't directed at other people who've come out even older in their lives.
Yeah. I wonder what it is about this person that, you know, was thrust in the public eye, as she said, since the time she was three. And the thing that I kept remembering and was talking to friends even this past weekend about, you know, mostly some straight women who were like, she seemed nervous. I was a little scared. You know, she made me feel uncomfortable. And I thought, you know, the other thing I said to every one of these women, because I was with a group of women, we were talking about it. And there were two gay women in the room and like four straight women. And we were talking about it. And I said, does anybody remember what happened to her when she was in college and she was 18 or 19? And no one did. And I said, does anybody remember that John Hinckley tried to assassinate a very beloved president when she was probably dealing with her sexuality, trying to live a normal life on a college campus? You know, that, and this was kind of pre-paparazzi and celebrities really being stalked to that length. But I know she was very fearful for her life even. She only wrote one article about it in Esquire magazine. But when I mentioned that, the women in the room all kind of went, oh my God, I forgot that, you know? So we forget the collective experience, I think, of people and whatever their journey is. And I'm surprised more news media didn't mention it.
Yeah, no, I absolutely kept defending her on Facebook just for that very fact. And so did some of my friends. That, can you imagine when you're a teenager that someone stalks you for months, you ignore them, and then they try to kill a president in your name, and your career choice is something that creatively puts you in front of the public.
Yeah.
Now, what her choice was at that point was to not be an actress or director, right?
Right.
So how do we put that on somebody? We can't. It's not her quote-unquote fault that she's in a very public profession. So I feel like she was like doubly punished because people are like, oh, well, you didn't have to be an actress. Well, she'd already been an actress, and that was her calling. So is she supposed to go back into a hole because someone stalked her and tried to kill Reagan in her name? No. But that does certainly play into her privacy issues. And she also had a very weird upbringing that played into that as well. So I can't, you know, I don't, there's nothing I can blame her. What I think is really interesting about her coming out, and I haven't even written a column about it because I felt like I was so torn about it. But what I really think is important is that her coming out doesn't matter at all to our movement, whereas 20 years ago, I do feel it would have helped us in the way that Ellen DeGeneres coming out and Melissa did. What's great about our movement now is we are so strong and so big and have so many allies, even in the White House on Inauguration Day, that we don't need Jodie Foster, which in fact then gives her more cover and more people like her to come out. And that's why so many celebrities have been coming out over the last couple of years, because they're under this they're not under the same kind of microscope that Ellen DeGeneres was in terms of temporarily losing her career and her career trajectory because she came out. So, I really wish that Jodie would have acknowledged that instead of almost belittling people who came out before her. That was the one part of the speech I really did not like. It's almost like she was saying, oh, all these people, you know, and then they go to Jane Lynch and the cutaway. I didn't feel the need to proclaim it. But you know what, Jodie? The reason you now can come out is because those people proclaimed it in a way that they had to do in order for the public to really understand how different they were. I mean, we don't have the benefit of just being seen as gay. We have to come out. Yeah. And that's an added burden that she really didn't acknowledge. So that's the only thing I really didn't like about her coming out.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I thought she was very, very nervous. But it's interesting if you read it or you go back and watch it, you know, more times than the first time. It's a very smart and very calculated speech. And I think she's making some distinctions around, you know, some of the things that we can say today, which is like the only thing about me is not that I'm gay, you know, and that she had been living her life out with her friends, families, colleagues, anyone she met. And she seemed to be making a real distinction that can only probably have been made in the past. Well, I would say definitely today, but in the past 5 or 7 years, is that, you know, she doesn't want to be a personality. She doesn't want to be a spokesperson, a personality. She doesn't want to be selling anything or selling her life. You know, she does not want to fall into the personality slash celebrity slash reality personality. You know, she wants to be an artist and her art and her work to express for themselves, you know, who she is and what she believes in. And I think that's a distinction that, I don't know. I don't even know if the younger generation knows the difference today.
Oh, I don't think so. I don't think that media allows them to have that distinction. If Lindsay Lohan had wanted to be more of this artiste and care about, you know, quality films and all that other kind of stuff, I don't know that she even had that choice ahead of her. Because of how she was pigeonholed so quickly by the media as a teenage actress. So I agree that Jodie's one of the last remaining that has been able to sustain that control and hopefully can continue to do that in the future. I think she has enough clout and power that she can. But a lot of these young actresses don't when they, you know, first enter. They're already on this certain trajectory that they're forced into because of publicists and the media. It almost seems like worse than in the days of Rock Hudson when he had to be forced married to cover up being gay. These people have to kind of force into these kind of projects that creatively they're stunted, even if they're not they're not stunted in their sexuality.
Right, right. Well, and I do admire the fact that she's never had a beard. She's never created a family other than her modern family, as she called it. And I think, you know, look, everybody judges their success based on various things, but it really seemed like that night that she was basing her success on a life in her art, her two children who couldn't have looked prouder at their mom on stage and heard every word that they said and have lived everything that she's talking about. And, you know, a co-parent who happens to be now an ex who still sat at that table, you know, and that is something that many of us, gay or straight, can't say we've been able to sustain and have as a success in our life. So seems to be working for her. It seems like she threw the world a bone and but tried to do it in her own way. And I applaud her. I'm glad, too, like you said, that it's not kind of the shot heard out, you know, around the world. It was a news stream for a while. And, yeah, we're going to talk about it a little bit. But I think it's because it was so different than how anybody else has done it. And it had a bit of a dangerous, rogue kind of, okay, I'm going to be a bit defensive and I'm also going to be a bit impassioned and also show you a bit of my sadness and what sacrifices have come from, you know, choices. But she seems like she can sleep at night with her choices, and that's about all any of us can say. So I am glad for that. Well, and I know, Tracy, you will probably continue to write that article, and people can look for continuing coverage in Windy City Times Weekly or download the papers at WindyCityMediaGroup.com, because I don't know that we're done talking about her yet, and I'm interested to see who next will come out after her, because we have not yet had the next person to come out. So there will always be another, because that's, as you said, what we have to do. We have to come out. Tracy's going to be on with us in another show where she's going to be talking about her new book called Gay Press, Gay Power, The Growth of the LGBT Community Newspapers in America. And I'll be excited to sit down and with Tracy and talk about her new book. So thanks, Tracy.
Thank you very much.
Well, and on today's show, before we break for the news and for what's going on in the theater world here around Chicago, we're going to be talking today with Kelly Simpkins. Many of you know her. She is also a friendly ex of mine and a former frequent co-host of the Windy City Queercast. And she's in a new show, a compelling new world premiere queer work that takes place on a college campus. Queer kids on a college campus, not a story we see every day on theater stages, at the Goodman Theater, called Teddy Ferrara. And we're going to be talking with Kelly about that and her history as well, just in being an openly LGBT voice in casts and in scripts that have been on stages for the past couple of decades in the theater. So Kelly Simpkins talking about Teddy Ferrara on today's Queercast.
Glamour, romance, and sensuality. See the Joffrey Ballet in American Legends. Jerome Robbins' Interplay conveys the wonderful playfulness and unfettered curiosity of youth. Gerald Arpino's lush duet, Sea Shadow, honors the 90th anniversary of his birth. The voice of Frank Sinatra sets you swinging in Twyla Tharp's classic Nine Sinatra Songs, costumed by Oscar De La Renta. Stanton Welch's exuberant and theatrical Son of Chambers Symphony makes its Chicago premiere. It's the Joffrey Ballet in American Legends at the Auditorium Theater of Roosevelt University, February 13th through the 24th. For tickets, call 800-982-2787 or visit joffrey.org.
I'm Kirk Williamson.
I'm Amy Matheny.
And this is the Week in News. President Obama, in his second inaugural address, emphasized the nation's principle of equality for all and, in doing so, specifically included the struggles of LGBT Americans to achieve equality. In part, he said, "We, the people, declare today that the most evident of truths, that all of us are created equal, is the star that guides us still, just as it guided our forebears through Seneca Falls and Selma and Stonewall." He also said, "Our journey is not complete until our gay brothers and sisters are treated like anyone else under the law, for if we are truly equal, then surely the love we commit to one another must be equal as well."
In Fort Bragg, North Carolina, an officer's spouse club has offered a special guest membership to same-sex spouse of an U.S. Army officer after earlier denying the woman's application to join the private organization. However, Ashley Broadway, a lesbian who is married to Lieutenant Colonel Heather Mack, rejected the offer, calling it not only offensive, but just plain hurtful. Broadway, who married Mack last November after the couple lived together for 15 years, said the offer treats her as less than equal.
Mayors from across the country attended a reception during the United States Conference of Mayors annual Washington, D.C. meeting to commemorate the first anniversary of a campaign that features city executives who support marriage rights for same-sex couples. Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa, Philadelphia Mayor Michael Nutter, lesbian Houston Mayor Anise Parker, gay Gainesville, Florida Mayor Craig Lowe, and Seattle Mayor Mike McGinn were among those who attended the reception at the Capitol Hilton in downtown Washington.
After not taking a position on the issue for years, the gay Republican organization Go Proud is coming out in support of same-sex marriage equality. Since its founding in 2009, Go Proud has always opposed the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, but it reportedly avoided the underlying issue of equal marriage.
Aircraft manufacturer Boeing has resisted granting equal survivor pension benefits to same-sex spouses, but now has agreed to do so. Executives at Boeing had previously told union negotiators that because federal law governs pensions, the company would not offer surviving same-sex spouses the same benefits as opposite-sex spouses.
Rhode Island moved one step closer to approving same-sex marriage when the House Judiciary Committee unanimously agreed to send a marriage equality bill to the full House. If the House and Senate pass the measure, gay couples could start getting married January 1, 2014. Supporters expect the measure to pass the state House, but passage through the state Senate is less certain.
A violent robber called the Western Bandit, who police believe is responsible for the death of a transgender woman and the shooting of another, is stalking the streets of Los Angeles again. The suspect frequents Western Avenue, which runs from Hollywood to Koreatown and through South Los Angeles. Authorities don't believe the suspect targets transgender women specifically, only those walking late at night or very early in the morning.
In North Carolina, 13 same-sex couples recently attempted to obtain marriage licenses but were denied. Organized by Campaign for Southern Equality, hundreds of supporters supporters lined up outside the Registered of Deeds office to cheer on the couples. Hours earlier, the group marched on the Greenville County Probate Court.
HRC is urging Defense Secretary Leon Panetta to issue military IDs to same-sex spouses and to extend every possible benefit not specifically barred by the Defense of Marriage Act. HRC contends that some of the regulatory changes Panetta could make involve issues such as personnel assignments, legal services, housing, and military ID cards.
Scientists at Stanford University have genetically engineered cells that are HIV resistant. The procedure uses molecular scissors to cut into T cells, followed by the insertion of a series of HIV resistant genes. This development could lead to an alternative therapy for people on heavy drug treatment plans.
In world news, in Australia, Tanya Herman, who's serving at least 9 years for attempted murder, has applied to marry prison lover Nicole Muscat. If Corrections Victoria approves the application, the two inmates hope to hold a commitment ceremony inside the Tardengower Women's Prison in May. Muscat began a 2-year prison term in July 2011 for stealing $118,000 from a venue she managed.
Israel has celebrated its first public transgender wedding. Chen Arizona married her husband, whose identity was not revealed. Arizona, who runs a salon near Tel Aviv, was born Erez Israeloff, one of 4 siblings in a traditional Orthodox Jewish family. Israel's Channel 2 Evening News televised the event, and it was seen throughout the country.
In Malta, same-sex couples are closer to achieving partnership rights after both the island nation's leading parties backed the idea. The Malta Gay Rights Movement hopes to have civil partnership in the next 5 years and marriage equality within 10 years. The Mediterranean archipelago is currently preparing for elections on March 9th.
In Nepal, the government will begin issuing gender-neutral citizenship documents for people who do not wish to be identified as male or female. Australia and New Zealand are among the other areas offering a gender-neutral option on passports.
Thousands of Dutch Catholics are researching how they can leave the church in protest as its opposition to same-sex marriage. Tom Rose, whose website allows people to download the documents needed to leave the church, said traffic on his site soared from about 10 to more than 10,000 daily visits after Pope Benedict's latest condemnation of marriage equality. About 28% of the population in the Netherlands is Catholic.
In Russia, military recruits' tattoos are going to be checked as the Kremlin believes they could reveal signs of homosexuality. Soldiers will receive thorough physical examinations to look for tattoos in places such as sexual organs and buttocks. While the Russian military holds traditional views on sexuality, a UN report from 2007 stated homosexuality and male prostitution is common within the army.
In entertainment news, the Film Society of the Lincoln Center has announced that Barbara Streisand will receive the annual Chaplin Award. Among Streisand's many accomplishments, the Society singled out in particular the 1983 film Yentl, which was the first film to credit a woman as writer, director, producer, and star. Past recipients include Meryl Streep, Elizabeth Taylor, Sidney Poitier, and Alfred Hitchcock.
HBO Documentary Films acquired the U.S. TV rights to the political documentary Pussy Riot, A Punk Prayer, which received its world premiere at Sundance Film Festival. The documentary covered the 3 women in the Russian feminist art collective who were arrested and prosecuted on charges of religious hatred after they performed a punk prayer inside a cathedral.
The film Bully was the top-grossing documentary of last year. The movie, which overcame an initial R rating, grossed $4.1 million, making it the 30th highest grossing documentary of all time.
Bisexual actress Amber Heard has dumped actor Johnny Depp and is reportedly with a female French model, Marie de Villepin. The two blondes, both 26, have been spotted together frequently in recent months.
Singer-songwriter Barry Manilow, who is struggling with bronchitis, canceled the 7 p.m. January 22nd performance of Manilow on Broadway. Previews began January 18th at Broadway's St. James Theater toward an official opening night of January 24th.
Sony Pictures Classics wrapped the Daniel Radcliffe movie Kill Your Darlings. In the film, Radcliffe portrays the late gay Beat Generation poet Allen Ginsberg and has a very explicit sex scene with Dane DeHaan, who plays friend Lucien Carr. The movie also stars Ben Foster, Michael C. Hall, and Elizabeth Olsen.
Ian McKellen and Patrick Stewart will team up on Broadway this fall in two of the most iconic plays of the 20th century. Stewart and McKellen will star in Harold Pinter's No Man's Land and Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot in repertoire. Stewart and McKellen starred in a production of Waiting for Godot in London's West End in 2009.
Country singer Shelley Wright and wife Lauren Blitzer Wright are expecting twins. The couple broke the news this week and said the twins are expected this summer.
And there will be an absolutely fabulous movie. Joanna Lumley, who plays Patsy on the TV series, confirmed Jennifer Saunders, who plays Adina, is writing the film, and Lumley will be stepping into Patsy's designer shoes. And that's the Week in News brought to you by Windy City Times.
This is Sharon Gless, and you're on the Windy City Queercast.
Culture Club. Culture Club. Culture Club. Theater.
Music.
Dance.
Art.
Performance.
Provocative.
Hilarious.
Exciting.
Queer.
Innovative.
Campy.
Edgy.
Original.
Get some culture in your life.
Join the club.
For the week of January 28th, 2013, you are in Chicago's Culture Club. Tickets are going fast for The Letters, a smart, sexy thriller of politics and disinformation, now playing at Writers Theater's Intimate Books on Vernon's base in Glencoe. The Chicago Tribune calls The Letters a taut, personal dance of menace and the ideal selection for this space and these actors. And the Sun-Times adds The Letters is mesmerizing. Get your tickets today for The Letters at writerstheater.org.
Pride Films and Plays presents Beautiful Thing, a lovely coming-of-age drama now in a critically hailed production at the Athenaeum Theater now through February 17th. After 20 years, the play remains funny, explosive, and a timely look at bullying and love between two teens finding themselves. For details and tickets, visit pridefilmsandplays.com. Beautiful Thing by Jonathan Harvey, the 20th anniversary production.
And for more Culture Club, visit WindyCityTimes.com.
Hello, Deb Pierce here, letting you know that we'd love to hear back from you. So go ahead. You know you want to. Post a comment.
Becky's in love again. It's out of the picture. Here comes Jen. Becky's in love again.
Teddy Ferrara is the new work by gay playwright Christopher Shin. Teddy Ferrara follows the life of an openly gay college student who faces a national tragedy on his campus during his senior year. And Kelly Simpkins, who's no stranger to the queer cast, having co-hosted many times, is in this cast, and it's a compelling new queer work, having its world premiere currently at the Goodman Theater here in Chicago. And we're just glad to have Kelly to stop from her rehearsal process to talk with us about the play. Hey, Kel, how are you?
Hey, Amy, I'm well. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's exciting. You know, it's obviously an obvious ask for me to say, hey, you want us to talk about the play? Then let's have Kelly on the show because our listeners know Kelly. Tell me just first, let's just start. What's kind of the story of this play, of Teddy Ferrara? What is the play about?
Well, I mean, it's kind of a hard one to articulate. I mean, in the bare bones of the articulation, I guess I would say this is about, you know, a handful of days at a major university, which we have set it at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Okay.
And it is, you know, there's certainly a queer protagonist, Gabe, and kind of what happens to this character and what happens to the characters around him and certainly faculty and administrators when a tragedy happens and what it does to the lives of these characters and how they... you know, in some ways defend and are complicit in how they're kind of spinning reality.
Yeah.
And worldview in terms of what this does to them personally and, you know, in their group of friends and in the larger kind of macro world of this university. I mean, it really is kind of like, you know, there's a lot of public and private. There's a lot of, you know, technology is certainly a character in this play.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of kind of how do we construct identity mm-hmm. In terms of these young kids and growing up in a world where technology is such a major, major force of their lives and how they communicate with each other.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot about university and how you impact and, you know, create policy mm-hmm. for LGBTQ students. And it's got a lot of stuff in it. I mean, it's, you know, there's a lot of questions that are asked and a lot of, you know, characters just kind of going along and dealing or not dealing with what the impact of this tragedy does to them personally and in the outer world.
Well, Christopher's never been shy to writing about or writing from a perspective of something that echoes a current event. Obviously, this play dealing with college campuses or schools in general, that as you said, that macro or micro community within a macro community of just you know, all the cast of characters that are around a school a school or a college. And there have been so many stories over the past few years that seem like they lead to this play being birthed. Has Christopher talked about what inspired him to write this play? Is it a lot of what's been going on college campuses? I mean, does, you know, Virginia Tech or Tyler Clementi or just the bullying stories, GLBT bullying stories that have continued to unfold in the past few years to the forefront impacted him?
Absolutely. I mean, he has spoken a great deal about, you know, that he really has kind of long held and been really wanting to write a play about bullying, particularly, you know, in the last several years, certainly in 2010, when there was just the string of suicides that were happening with all of these young kids mm-hmm. Who were being bullied, and that he really, you know, and that what that had the impact of that caused him to think about himself.
Mm-hmm.
And his college years, and obviously, you know, what happened at Rutgers with Tyler Clementi was kind of a springboard for this story. Mm-hmm. Certainly, it is not a mirror of this story at all.
Mm-hmm.
And Christopher is pretty explicit in the fact that he, you know, he's not writing an issue play.
Mm-hmm.
He's really writing a play about human relationships and love. Mm-hmm. And how we meet people and things happen. And we, you know, he used this really beautiful phrase on the first day of rehearsal where, you know, he said, we meet people and it touches a trauma in us or it touches a trauma in them. And kind of what is the burden and what is the healing of that? And in some ways, you know, I think this tragedy kind of that's at the epicenter of this play is really about like what is the trauma in all of these characters or what is the healing, you know, how do they really look at it in a conscious way or how do they kind of defensively kind of spin it out in a conscious or unconscious way? So I think he really is writing about human interaction and human relationship more than like, I'm going to write a play about queer kids, or I'm going to write a play about bullying. I think it really for him is like writing about the heart of characters interacting.
It's so interesting where there's no, you know, when you think about your college years, that time between the transition from, you know, we have a lot of, you know, podcasting is a very young medium. So a lot of our listeners are younger. You know, when you think about that time of moving from your teens into adulthood and your first time living on your own and you're without kind of a reprieve or escape because you're living 24/7 within this nucleus community. Many kids are, and I don't know, but I assume this college campus is, they live on campus and it's more that kind of a university because I'm familiar with, you know, University of Wisconsin-Madison. It's a fairly, there's a campus and there's an area. It's not spread out all over the city, like we would say a much bigger university.
Right.
That creates drama in and of itself, just characters having to coexist and the differences between people. It seems unusual that we haven't had more plays that are derivative of the collegiate experience.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I really applaud the Goodman for taking on this play and producing the world premiere of this play, because I think it's really, it's an important group of kids, particularly, and they're not all gay kids in this play. Mm-hmm. There are a few straight characters, as it were.
Uh-huh.
But I think it's really rare to see a play about young queer kids kind of just grappling not only with their queerness and homosexuality, but just grappling with their own identity and the construction of that identity and kind of, what it means to suddenly, as you said, kind of be on your own, be in this kind of new fledgling world and, kind of thrown into the abyss in some ways, as it were. Mm-hmm. Without any of the familial and familiar structures that you have come to know. And I think it's a really provocative time in terms of the evolution of oneself. And, I think in some ways, the tragedy that occurs in this play really calls up, who people are and how they respond and what they do with that information.
Mm-hmm.
That then kind of creates something further in themselves, like a ripple. It's almost like a stone being thrown into the water,
yeah,
or skimmed on the water. So I think it's amazing to have a play that deals with this particular group of people, mm-hmm, on a college campus. What that means, because it's such a unique experience for all of us,
Yeah.
And something that we all grapple with.
Yeah. When did you come out? Were you in your young teens, 20s, when you came out?
I mean, it feels so late comparatively when I hear about kids coming out in grade school or high school. I came out at 24, and that was really, really late for me. And I, mm-hmm, did not complete college, but I remember being in college, and it was a really, hard time for me. And there were, mm-hmm, some really wonderful moments when I was there, but there was a lot of pain and a lot of questioning and a lot of shame around the fact that I knew I was gay and really hadn't come to terms with that yet, or was trying to come to terms with that, kind of, mm-hmm, as I said, being kind of thrown into this world where I was suddenly on my own and meeting lots of people that I had never met and coming up against, a lot of things and a lot of teachings and a lot of different people and a lot of ideas that I was struggling to kind of digest and kind of pull together within myself. So it was, it's such a provocative time in the forming of oneself.
Mm-hmm.
And I look at that experience as it was a really hard one for me.
Yeah. I mean, I think most people have a very visceral response to this time period in their life, early 20s, college or no college, late teens, early 20s. And so I imagine that this play feels very personal to be in it. And I imagine that the hope, from what you said from Christopher, is that it will feel very personal to experience the play and watch the play, whether,
yeah,
you're gay or straight,
absolutely.
That time, as you said, of bringing yourself to who your identity is. Cause I feel like that's really the first time we get to do that, is when we've left home and after high school. That high school kind of imposes these identities upon us, and then somehow we either hold on to those or we radically change those or alter those slightly in some way, after high school and in college.
And it is kind of this maelstrom of metamorphosis. And I think about, I just want to say this, Amy, when I, I did not have technology. I didn't have a smartphone. There wasn't, it's a very different world today. And, as a friend reminded me this morning, we're in a world right now where, we have elected to a second term, a president who has, openly come out, in support of equal rights for all people.
Yeah.
So it's a really different kind of world. And I think in some ways, particularly in the last few years, as many strides as we've made in the LGBTQ community, there has been a backlash that has been so severe.
Mm-hmm.
I think part of the kind of mirror on all of these kids and all the bullying and everything that's happening, it's become in some ways a better world and a more frightening world as a result.
Yeah,
the backlash has been so strong.
I was really thinking today to prep for this interview of kind of looking at gay plays, and I always, when I'm talking to gay playwrights or about doing an interview about a play, kind of trying to just go, why this play right now, the definition of what a gay play, how that evolves. And, you know, you look at the late 70s and those plays like The Band Played On, you know, were kind of about like how our hidden communities functioned, our little tight-knit social groups, right? And in the 80s and 90s, it's, you know, the effect of AIDS, whether it's Angels in America or Love Valor or Baltimore Waltz, you know, being impacted by how AIDS and HIV affected our community. And then it seems like, you know, we're having these new struggles in the past decade or so about these, and I'm thinking primarily of a play that you're involved with, but these stories of survival or lack of survival, you know, bullying and murders, you know, with the Laramie Project and or in a play like this, you know, that it's really interesting. I wonder, like, God, are we going back to the early days of the previous century where we were having plays like The Children's Hour, you know, where, but what is this new, you know, this long journey that we are on, you know, towards strengthening ourselves as a community and stepping out into the light. And so I do want to ask you, because you're one of the original creators and performers of the Laramie Project. I mean, probably one of the most highly produced plays of the past 20, you know, years. And obviously for GLBT people, one of the most significant plays, gay plays of the past century, you know, also about a young man. Like Teddy Ferrara. Laramie being about a true story. But that play, from what I'm understanding, is and what I know is besides being a documentary play, is also the eyes of how the loss of Matthew Shepard impacted a community. And how is Teddy Ferrara, you know, the lens of that, are we actually getting to know the victim or the person in the center of this, or is it an echo of the Laramie Project, and it's really looking at the impact of the tragedy on a community, or is it both?
Well, I think it's both in this case. I mean, part of what, you know, Christopher said in an interview is that when he came to see the Laramie Project, the one story that was missing in his, or the one character that was missing, was Matthew Shepard.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously that was a huge kind of struggle in terms of, you know, it was a big question, and I think it was answered fairly early on that Matthew would not be a character in this play, that he would, you know, that he obviously is a huge character in the play, but that personifying him was not something that we were interested in. It was really kind of creating a community that spoke to him and spoke to, you know, what they were going through in the aftermath of his murder. So, you know, the difference here being that you do get to see this character, and you do get to, you know him a little bit, and it's complicated, you know, and it is that kind of thing of like, can we hold the complication in someone and still care about them? And I think it's something that is, you know, from the outside, and certainly from people who think of LGBTQ folks as an enemy, as it were, you know, the complication is called up, and it, I think it diminishes humanity. Mm-hmm. So this is not, you know, these are not, these are incredibly complicated characters.
Yeah.
You know, and I think all of them are. Even my character, who's, you know, an openly gay gender studies professor, you know, uses a moment in some ways. It's like, you know, part of this play is like, how do we spin reality for our own personal gain? You know, how do we take a moment in time that is an opportunity to kind of push forward something that feels incredibly important? Not necessarily at the expense of someone, but because we feel like it's the right thing to do. So I think these are all incredibly complicated characters grappling with something. And I don't want that to be, you know, I mean, the thing that, you know, I don't think they're dismissing because of their complication. And I think Christopher, you know, has written an incredibly cerebral, really beautiful, really complicated play. And I think, you know, it's hard. I think a lot of people want to make LGBT human beings and characters really simple and really beautiful to be embraced. And, you know, and I think that's bullshit, quite frankly. I mean, I think we're all complicated, and the acceptance of a community is not about simplicity.
Yeah.
There's a lot of depth.
Well, and I, we're being more transparent now, right? So we get to be more fully understood and realized individuals in society. So that's, I think, being reflected hopefully in our art too, or maybe the art is helping it be reflected, you know, which came first, you know, the art or the you know, society's perception, or is art teaching society how to perceive? But that's really smart. That's really, really interesting. I'm curious, something that you just said of like, you know, okay, taking a moment and making it work for, you're talking about your character, Ellen, who's the gender studies professor, you know, taking a moment where you have a perspective, you know, a motive, you know, a political angle a character might have, you know, to rising to a moment. You, Kelly Simpkins, openly gay actress, you know, in the world of theater, you see theater as a form, of an important form to kind of tell stories, to, you know, invest your heart and your art and your career and your, you know, it's where you've chosen to make your profession. And you've played a lot of gay characters.
I have.
And is that important to you? And is it important to you to cultivate, you know, bring yourself to that, to do the exact same thing that Ellen may be doing in this play? I was just saying without judgment, and I'm not judging your character because I haven't seen the play yet. I'm just saying, to rise to an occasion of a moment, to actually bring your voice to a gay play, to a gay character.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, I think politics is all about opportunity in a lot of ways. And, you know, there's a lot of backslapping and there's a lot of patience. There's, you know, there's a lot of manipulation in politics. And some of it is, you know, we can tell ourselves, not that I'm in politics, but certainly, you know, in my understanding of this character, you know, there is, you know, a rare opportunity comes up, and as it benefits all or could benefit more, you take the opportunity and use it, not for your personal gain necessarily, even though I think that's part of it, but for legislation and policies across the university that could really have the greatest amount of impact. So I think that's incredibly complicated. And in a way, I think, you know, at the end of the day, Teddy Ferrara is everyone, is all of these characters. And for me, you know, I was thinking about this morning and thinking, because I obviously know you and I know this podcast. And, you know, I was thinking about before I came out and before I moved to New York when I was 20. And I was really lucky to be involved in the shooting of A League of Their Own.
Right.
And I was thinking about, you know, when I realized I was going to quit college and move to New York, and I said to Gina Davis, do you have any advice for me, or what would you say to me as I move to this big city and kind of try to start this life? And she said, be more of what they accuse you of. And I didn't realize the impact then of what that statement would have on me as a human being. I certainly wasn't out at that point. I came out like 3 years later, and, you know, in terms of my career, I literally thought, like, what do they accuse me of? They accuse me of being tall, they accuse me of being masculine, they accuse me of being gay, you know, they accuse me of all these things, and I thought, my God, you know, these things are going to be liabilities in my career, and now, in hindsight, they have only been assets. And what a beautiful kind of thing that is, you know, as I was thinking about that this morning and as I've thought about that in the last several months, like I have had the privilege of playing characters that a lot of women would never get the opportunity to play. And it has worked for me that, you know, I love a good story and I love a complicated character, and I've gotten to play some incredible men and women because of who I am and because of what I've been accused of in a lot of ways. And it has, you know, I feel very proud of the work that I've done and the playwrights that I've worked with and the directors that I work with and the stories that I've told. Because I think in a lot of ways, you know, the theater can speak to the invisible and the people that don't have a voice, and can really show the audience either, you know, a side of a life, a side of a character, where hopefully potentially they can walk out and feel like they understand humanity and they understand the blocks in themselves in a deeper way. Mm. Because I come to the theater that way as well. Mm. Being an openly lesbian person, looking at Latino life or looking at African-American life or looking at people that, you know, I certainly think I know, mm-hmm. but, you know, get to sit with in a very deep way in 2 hours of a play that unfolds in a dark theater. Mm-hmm. And I don't necessarily come out as a different person necessarily, but hopefully I come out with a little more humanity and a little bit more of an evolved philosophy and a little bit less hate, because I think people do come in as they are.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know. I was just thinking about that. Maybe I'm not articulating
no,
that
you
in the
are.
Best
I mean,
possible
I think
way. But
I think it's really interesting because, you know, whatever mm-hmm. you've felt like has marginalized you has allowed you to step into perhaps marginalized characters. I mean, I know your career, too, and I know you've also played trans characters. And, you know, there aren't that many actors out there who potentially could play a trans character with the same authenticity as you know, as maybe you have. It doesn't mean people haven't. I mean, Felicity, you know, Huffman did.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, yeah. Is that her name? Felicity? Is that her name? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, you've had that opportunity and, you know, you've had the opportunity to be the embodiment of very important characters for many gay and lesbian playwrights. I mean, looking at your bio, you know, it's like Moises Kaufman, you know, at the Laramie Project, Lee Fondakowski, where I know you've worked on the Charlotte Cushman play, the great American openly lesbian actress that probably most people don't know who she is. So maybe you want to Wikipedia, or I guess you wouldn't Wikipedia, but good Google Charlotte Cushman if you're hearing that, because that work's still happening. You know, working with Roberto Aguirre Sacasa, who has now working for Glee, but wrote Good Boys and True, where you didn't play a gay character, but, you know, you were a part of that world. And then, you know, Sarah Gubbins, who's been on the podcast and who you've had significant collaborations on with most recently the kid thing, and you know, and the honor it is that you were nominated for Best Actress in Chicago for that role of a you know, not the most easily digestible openly lesbian woman, you know.
No, yeah, absolutely.
So I think,
and
it,
I love
it
that progress. Again, it's like, you know, I love that there is a representation of something that isn't easy,
yeah,
that is complicated, that is complex.
Yep.
That is speaking to something in all of us, and what we do with that information kind of as an audience, in terms of, you know, filtering or digesting or defending or, you know, mm-hmm. creating barriers or creating kind of openings. It's like, what creates the fissure? And I, you know, Amy, it's an incredible privilege to have the career that I have had. And mm-hmm. I, you know, I'm grateful for that every day. And, you know, if I only play gay and lesbian and transgender characters for the rest of my life, it would be a fantastically, you know, beautiful career to me.
Well, that's not all
that I want to play, but no. I'm really lucky that I've gotten to play these characters because they've changed me, and hopefully they've impacted other people who have watched them. So it's pretty amazing, you know, that'd be more of what they accuse you of.
Yeah,
that it has only been a gain in my life personally and professionally.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like, you know, you also have the ability to impact a lot of these young actors that are in the show. And it's so great. I've been around you so many times when people come up and say how much the Laramie Project impacted them, gay and straight, you know, because it's such a play that is done in high schools and in on college campuses. So often the Laramie Project is performed in high schools and colleges. So it's obviously creating change. I know that the Goodman and this play, Teddy Ferrara, they are really trying and really want young people to come and see this play. And obviously it's not, as you said, it's not an issues play. It's not a gay play. It's a play about our time and what's happening in our world right now. And you know, many kids are getting bullied that in elementary school and in high school who may not be gay, you know, they haven't even identified yet. But the stigma of being gay is something that, you know, has created kids to take their lives, a situation where kids will take their lives and feel so tormented
and unsafe in their school environments. So I know they want schools to come out. There will be talkbacks every Wednesday night that the show is playing, and it's a fairly short run. It's primarily the month of February, February 2nd through March 3rd. And one of the cool things that the Goodman is doing is they've always had these student $10 tickets, but normally you have to get them day of. Well, if you're a student, you have a student ID, you can now purchase advance tickets. So purchase in advance. So you are guaranteed tickets for this show, for Teddy Ferrara. And if you do that, you go to their website, goodmantheater.org. And when you're buying tickets for the night you go see the show, you can use a promo that is 10TIX. So it's 10 ticks, 10TIX. Or you can call the box office and tell them that you're a student and say, I want the 10 ticks student ticket for Teddy Ferrara. And if you bring, as long as you bring your ID, when you pick them up, you can get them, and you can get up to 4 tickets at that price. So that's
amazing. Cool. Yeah, it's really incredible that they're doing that, and I'm hoping that a lot of students come out and a lot of young kids come out.
Yeah,
because I think it's a play for them. It's a play for everybody, but it's specifically a play for them in a lot of ways. And you know, I mean, as we're talking about the Laramie Project, you know, part of this play is about, and as I said before, Christopher was really thinking about like his college years and kind of the difference between, and he's also a professor at the New School and has sat on committees and obviously teaches graduates and has taught some undergraduates, but you know, how the world has changed. You know, really wanting to write a play about this. And I remember being on, you know, we were doing the Laramie Project tour in 2010, and I remember so distinctly in a talkback that we had, you know, Lee Pondikowski saying, you know, I really thought when this tour was announced and we kind of solidified all the dates and all the places, that this play, these plays would feel historical.
Mm.
and they didn't. I mean, they felt incredibly resonant and incredibly timely, because it really was that time where it's like every town we came into, there was another suicide that was announced in the media. You know, I think it speaks to so many things that are happening right now, so many, you know, kind of all of the, you know, and I think we're hopefully moving to a different place with this, but there is a lot of LGBTQ oppression and a lot of kind of sanctioned policy, both at the school level and bullying and all the Christian right and everything that's in our schools and everything that's happening politically right now, that, you know, I think the tide is turning, hopefully, but I think it's really, really necessary to talk about these things and how they impact our lives and potentially take our lives, because, it's a sad time and it's a beautiful time.
Yeah.
And the commingling of those two things is a really interesting moment, kind of historically, what we're going to do.
It's interesting.
Not just as LGBTQ people, but as human beings.
Right. Well, and as allies, I think, you know, I've always said for more than a decade on the radio that, you know, the real change for the GLBT community is going to be when our straight allies really join the community and help take us to the next level. You know, the African American community 150 years ago needed white allies, you know, to make that happen. And because at the time, the power, you know, the power structure was not equal. And so you need that. You need the people who have some power and have some voice and have some platform to help, you know, lend a hand and rise an oppressed community up. And we are seeing that for the first time historically, you know, with a sitting president saying he supports same-sex marriage, and the NAACP saying, you know, we support same-sex marriage, and you know, the National, you know, Latin organization. And you know, there's going to be follow-away, and there's going to be this is when the pendulum is going to swing, and we're seeing this, and this is not like a thing that's going to happen in 1 year, you know. 150 years later, you know, we're still, you know, equal rights for, you know, African American people in this country, you know, it's still a challenge. And we are a young community in the fight for equality. So this play continues that conversation. And I hope if you're in the Chicago community, in the GLBT community, able to get to this play be a part of this conversation that's happening downtown at the Goodman Theater. I hope that you will make a point to attend this world premiere of Teddy Ferrara, which is running February 2nd through March 3rd only. So it's a shortish run. You got about a month to get there, so don't wait. It's playing at
And I hope people please come.
Yeah, it's playing at the Owen Theater at the Goodman, 170 North Dearborn, downtown Chicago. As I said, Wednesday performances. There are talkbacks about the play. I am sure those will be extremely compelling. Tickets are available at goodmantheater.org/Teddy, and we'll have that linked in our show notes. You can also call the Goodman, 312-443-3800, or you can just walk up to the box office if you happen to be downtown and buy your tickets. Students, don't forget, you get to take advantage of that $10 ticket if you mention 10TIX. That's 10 ticks when you call the box office, walk up to the box office, or you can use that promo code when buying tickets online. And just remember, now those 10 tickets can be done in advance. You just need to bring your ID when you come to the show. Kelly, have a wonderful opening. Thank you for being an out LGBT person to be bringing your voice to these rooms and the creation of new LGBT work. And we're so glad to have your voice here with us on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you very much. And I really hope people come out and support this play. It's it's an amazing cast. I think these young actors and all the elder actors, as I'm calling us now, of which I am one of them, which is really, really kind of funny and strange to say, but
right.
It's such a beautiful cast and a really complex and beautifully written show by Christopher Shin. And Evan Cabinet is a New York director who's here and could not be more wonderful. So I'm incredibly proud to be a part of this project, and I really hope people come out and support it. So thank you for having me and just speaking to all of these things today, Amy.
You are welcome. Teddy Ferrara, don't miss it. The Goodman Theater, February 2nd through March 3rd.
Got something to say? Call us today. 312-21-BE-GAY.
Well, everybody, I hope you will go out and see Goodman Theater's Teddy Ferrara. I want to thank Kelly Simpkins for being on the show. I also want to say, I hope that in this chilly month of February that you will get out and heat things up. You know, it's the month of love. Love is very warm and sexy. And I hope you will catch the big sexy show at the main stage on Valentine's Day, February 14th at the Park West, 8 o'clock. Michelle L'Amour and the Chicago Starlets all doing their amazing burlesque. Plus, they have the Mr. Gorgeous from New York City, the amazing Tomas, all hosted by very funny Cameron Esposito. And it's their 10th year, folks. So let's honor burlesque in Chicago. They have kept the burlesque torch alive. And their shows are always very queer and very fun and very sexy and hot. So something to do during the Valentine's month. On the day of Valentine with your Valentine, the big sexy show with Michelle L'Amour. Stay warm, everybody, and get in the mood of love. Thanks for listening to another Windy City Queercast. Special thanks to our Queercast family, Kirk Williamson, newscaster, and Di Sturkey, production editor. I'm Amy Matheny, your host. Please comment on our shows at WindyCityQueercast.com and iTunes. The next Queercast is only days away, so don't miss it. Subscribe today. Windy City Queercast. Queer and now. Guaranteed. Whoa, whoa, oh.